I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Later, remembering Lady Bird, my Can I Just Tell You commentary. But first, they are images burned into our psyche. Angry whites screaming at black students trying to enroll in school. Battered 14-year-old Emmett Till in his coffin. The stunned aftermath on a balcony where slain Martin Luther King Jr. spent his last moments. For many of us, these are images out of time. But for one reporter, they were just the story of the day. The great Simeon Booker had a front row seat to some of the biggest social and political events of the late 20th century as he reported for Ebony and Jet magazines. The 88-year-old Booker only recently retired from the magazines as his hearing began to fail. Writer Will Haygood caught up with Booker for a rare in-depth interview and profiled him in yesterday's issue of the Washington Post Sunday Magazine. Haygood joins us now in the studio. Will, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
What made you want to write about Simeon Booker?
When I was coming up and started to dream of writing in newspapers sometimes with my grandfather, who was from Selma, Alabama, who I lived with, you know, we would sit at home in Ohio and watch the news shows on Sunday morning in the 60s. And now and then, there was this one black face on there, this man in this lovely bow tie and this nice suit. It was Simeon Booker. It just gave me encouragement, I think, inspiration to know that a very suave, learned black man had achieved these things. And now he was sitting up there on national TV sharing his knowledge. It just, I think, even though he wasn't writing for the big mainstream newspapers, the stories that he covered and that he wrote, they mattered. They mattered. To insist to his editors, this is a story in Birmingham, this is a story in Montgomery, this is a story Reverend George Lee is trying to register blacks to vote, this is a story, send me, I'm ready to go. And he'd take off with his little manual typewriter and, you know, hop in a car and go get his stories.
And he's never really told his story before. He's never written a memoir.
No.
Why is that?
I think shyness is due to some of it. And I also think there was a point late in his career when he was thinking about writing in Martin Luther King Jr. assassination, Medgar Evers being gunned down, Reverend George Lee being killed trying to register blacks to vote. And I think just a great sadness washed over him. And I just don't think he was able to pick up the ink pen and do it.
He's like Zelig. He was everywhere. I'm not sure people recognize just how many of the great stories of the civil rights movement he covered. I mean, would you talk about his role in bringing those famous pictures of Emmett Till in his coffin, who was a boy who was lynched, mm-hmm. and mother brought him back to Chicago to be buried?
Right.
And how did those pictures happen? How is it that that story happened?
Simeon Booker in Chicago was smart enough to hustle over to Mamie Bradley's house immediately after news had hit about her son being missing. And she wasn't getting very many visitors from the mainstream media. And so Simeon Booker looked around and knew that, and he established a rapport with her. And so she trusted him. She subsequently demanded that her son's body be brought back to Chicago, and Simeon Booker asked her if he could accompany her to the funeral home to see the body. He took a photographer with him, and they started shooting photographs, and he was, you know, in her orbit from then on out.
And of course, this murder, the murder of this 15-year-old boy for allegedly, you know, whistling at a white woman, had a huge impact on public opinion.
Yes, it did. And I think that suddenly the whole country knew that the issue of racial murders was not going to go away, nor should it be allowed to go without due punishment.
And the other important thing about this is it put the African-American press on the map, as it were, because they were the source of these pictures of the story, that you had to get those pictures from Ebony and Jet magazines.
Yes.
And that was important, too, as I recall.
It was a seminal moment, I think, with the Negro press, as it was known. It was an opportunity for the Negro press to make its mark, to go head-to-head with mainstream press, and to show the outside world that journalists who worked for the black newspapers were just as sophisticated, just as heady, just as smart, just
as
hard-working, yes, as journalists anywhere else.
And speaking of the mainstream press, I learned a lot of things from your article, Will. One of the things I learned is that Simeon Booker was the first black reporter at the Washington Post.
Yes.
But he did not stay.
No.
Why?
No. He was just there for 2 years. It was 1952 through 1954, being the first black in any situation is going to be tough. He was hired by Phil Graham, who is a wonderful publisher, but it wasn't like Phil Graham could shadow Simeon Booker in and out of the newsroom. And so down on the newsroom floor, Simeon Booker felt very lonely.
What is it, that he didn't get assignments, that nobody would send him out on stories? What?
Well, there just wasn't friendships. People didn't invite him over to their homes in the evening for a drink or dinner. You know, he wanted to talk about what he had studied at Harvard University. He was a Nieman Fellow at Harvard.
Which is a very prestigious journalism fellowship, for those who aren't aware.
Yes.
Competitive.
Yes, he was he was only the second black to receive that honor. And so he was this very learned figure, and he sort of had no place to erupt with it in Washington, even though he was at the Washington Post. He told me, he said he would go out and he would introduce himself to people as Simeon Booker of the Washington Post, and he said people would throw their heads back and just start laughing out loud in his face because they thought he was joking, because they had never met a black reporter from the Washington Post. I mean, that's just heartbreaking.
So he left and did go to Ebony and Jet magazine, and I'm tempted to say the rest is history, but part of the history that you tell is just how dangerous it was for him to do his job. Will you talk about some of the strategies that he employed to stay alive?
Yes.
Stay alive.
Literally,
this is not an exaggeration.
You know, it really is not, and I think people tend to sort of soft coat sometimes the horror in this country if you were black traveling alone in the South trying to do a job, register people to vote, or like Simeon Booker, get his newspaper story. He would often fly into Memphis, and he was a very well-dressed man. Always, you know, very continental, but he would change into overalls and sort of a loosely hanging shirt. He would try to sort of fit in with the scenery. He didn't want to stand out, and oftentimes he would walk around with a thick Bible and tell people that he was a minister, so no one would harm him as he got deeper into the South. It was just his strategy, I think, to stay alive. I mean, you had to stay alive on the civil rights beat. It was a tough beat.
I'm talking with Washington Post magazine writer Will Haygood about his profile this week of the legendary reporter Simeon Booker. And it has to be said that white reporters were not exempt. There were white reporters who were killed in the course of covering the movement.
Yes.
One reporter was covering the attempts to integrate Ole Miss.
Yes.
Who was killed, a European reporter.
Yes.
One of the other interesting revelations of the piece, and I don't know whether other people knew this, but according to your profile, Simeon Booker became pretty friendly with one of J. Edgar Hoover's top officials at the FBI. This is obviously interesting now because the agency is now known to have spied on civil rights leaders like Martin Luther King Jr. So how did this relationship happen, and why was Booker involved?
Yes, I think it's very fascinating. A top aide to J. Edgar Hoover, a man by the name of Deke DeLoach, became friends with Simeon Booker after Simeon had gotten back from covering civil rights. The FBI had read Semyon Booker's coverage and wondered, hey, maybe he can tell us some things about what's really going on in the South. And as Semyon Booker became friends with Mr. DeLoach, Mr. DeLoach wanted to inform Semyon Booker of which towns might be safe and which towns might not be safe to travel through in the South. And so Semyon Booker secretly in his own mind would give the FBI a lot of credit, even if he wouldn't tell his black or liberal friends that he was being aided by the FBI because of the FBI's reputation.
Does he see himself, or do you see him, as an informant?
Somebody like Semyon Booker out there in the South all alone might at midnight need a friend, might need somebody who is powerful, who can tell him what move to make and not to make. And so in hindsight, we didn't know at the time as well that the FBI wasn't doing everything that it said it was doing. And so I think Semyon Booker felt that he needed to utilize every perk, every person that he possibly could to stay on top of the story. He flat out says that he wouldn't have been able to survive in the South as long as he did keep going back and forth were it not for intelligence that the FBI shared with him. And so, you know, hey, for me to sit here all these years later and say that he was an informant or that it wasn't morally wise for him to do what he did, it's just very difficult to make judgment because I wasn't there in the little rooming house in 1956 wondering who might be coming up the road.
How is Mr. Booker?
He's doing well. He's doing well. I had opportunity to speak with him a few days ago, and I spent hours and hours with him while I was doing the story.
We'll give him our best.
I will.
Will Haygood is a staff writer at The Washington Post. His profile of the legendary journalist Semyon Booker appeared this week in The Washington Post Sunday Magazine. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.